Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2005. This session, Responding to the Muslim World, the question concerning jihad, presented by Nellie Van Doornharter in the Fireside Room, disc number VAN-2005-06. Let's listen in.
Okay, so several of you don't know me yet, maybe. My name is Nellie Van Doornharter, and I teach Islam and world religions at Valparaiso University. And nobody knows where Valparaiso is. It's 50 minutes away from the heart of Chicago. So it is in almost in Illinois, just over the border, and people there call it Michiana. They don't feel they're Indiana, they're Michiana, Michigan, Indiana. So, and I used to be a missionary, first in Egypt. When I was in Egypt, I worked for the Dutch Reformed Church because I was born and raised in the Netherlands, where everybody is Calvinist, also the Catholics in their heart. And so I worked, there's only 20,000 Lutherans in the Netherlands, and mostly are from Germany, with refugees from the war, so we have mostly a Reformed Church. And there I was in charge of the refugee agency. And then that's where I met my husband, who's American. And then we both went out for the Division for Global Mission of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And we both worked in Indonesia, where we taught at an interdenominational seminary for 5.5 years. So having lived in the Muslim world, you know, one cannot but look around and see a lot of Islam around and a lot of Muslims doing things. And so from that point of view, I thought I'll try to explain a little bit about what is happening today with, as lots of people call it, all these suicide bombers. And that is why in the title for today we have jihad. And I know that Antonio is sitting somewhere upstairs and wants to start the tape rolling. Antonio, we can start if you can hear me. So we're now going to talk about jihad. And as you see, I already tried in a very crude way to show you that we don't have one type of jihad or one type of suicide bombers. And there's a lot of different, there's space here if you want to come, Hans. There's a lot of different drives and motivations that bring people to certain points, and also not everybody becomes a suicide bomber. So let's just start with some questions. When I ask you, what do you think that a very extremist Muslim who could become a suicide bomber if the right conditions were there, what does that very extremist Muslim, and let's call it youth, because I think we have very few suicide bombers over 35, don't we? As you get middle-aged, you calm down a bit, I guess. And so even very, very fanatic people calm down to, or they start to put their energy into books, in writing books. Well, what does such a Muslim have in common, Muslim youth have in common with a very, very, well, how can I say it, fundamentalist, far-right Christian youth, Christian young person? What do you think they have in common?
Zeal.
What?
Zeal.
Zeal. Zeal. Absolutely. Zeal. That's a good word. Zeal. I'm going to write the words down.
Passion.
Passion. Right.
Imposition of beliefs.
Imposition. Right. Imposition of beliefs. Can we make that one word? Truth.
Indoctrinated.
Indoctrinated. Like, shall we call it truth? Do you know what I mean? What you say is the truth. Is that a little bit what you mean?
Dogma.
Dogma. Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Dogma. Dogma. Or let's say dogmatic, right? It's not just dogma, it's quite okay. Dogmatic. Okay, anything else?
Are they brainwashed?
Brainwashed, yeah.
Yeah, brainwashed. So let's say sect. Shall we call it sect type, sect-like, you know, background?
Cultish.
What?
Cult-like, brainwashed.
Sect, cult, right, brainwashed. Anything else?
Alienated from the mainstream.
Yes. Right. So let's say, remove yourself from society. Keep yourself, shall we call it purity? Keep yourself pure from everything else. right? That everything else around you is bad and stinks and can pollute you, yeah?
Anger / hatred.
Whoa, good one. Anger. The zeal and the passion have, as a flip side, huge anger and hatred. Absolutely, yeah. Well, do you recognize an ultra-right Christian young person in that? Can you recognize in that, yeah? I don't know them, so I don't dare to draw too many conclusions here, but my point is that in every religion you have basically people who are unhappy, right? Who are seeking for a new model, who are looking for a new way to live out their religion. And then when we look at the Muslim world and we wonder what is it that drives these waves, that what we now call, there's a space here, you got one? You have a space? Okay. The waves of what we call fundamentalism or extremism or anti-Westernism, where does it come from? Well, we cannot just give one answer because it has a long history. But what we are seeing nowadays, what we are seeing today, and remember yesterday we talked about the women and we said it is really a symbol of a huge battle that's going on in the Muslim world to look at where should the position of women be. And in a way, this extremism is the same. It is a symbol of all kinds of currents of beliefs and ideas that are going through the Islamic world, and where, in a way, the center has come. The center has come. Nobody knows anymore what to believe, whom to follow, who is in authority exactly. Can we recognize that a little bit? Because who is exactly the authority? Do we have one authority? No. So it is, in a way, it is very much Westernization, modernization that you're looking at. It is a modern phenomena in the sense that in the old days, if you think about this, you know, the Islamic world, in the old days there was the village imam, like we had the village pastor or the village priest, and didn't that person have a lot of authority and wisdom and knew everything? Well, it was the same in the Muslim world. And that is breaking down. That is disappearing. And so now, remember we talked yesterday also about individualization. Now the individual can decide what true Islam is. Now, what do you think? What are the main sources to find out what true Islam is if you are not a scholar of Islam? Because let me tell you one more time, to become a good, solid scholar of Islam, invest at least 20 years of study. At least. Okay? Sistani, we know Sistani? Sistani, the Ayatollah in Iraq. The man has at least studied 30 years, if not more. You need to know the Quran by heart, you need to know the tradition by heart, you need to know all the interpretation by heart. There's space here. Go ahead. And you need to and you need to be able to provide your own interpretations. And to learn that whole body means you have to learn the body of wisdom that started after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the year 632. Mm-hmm. So can you count the years that of compounded knowledge that you have to know? You have to know that whole body. Now, most people don't have that whole body of knowledge anymore. So where do you think most people get their knowledge? What can you imagine? Like we think suicide bombers just now in England. We all heard about them, right? Where do you think they got their knowledge?
Parents.
Huh?
Parents.
Parents. From their parents they got the basics. The basics of the Quran. They became Muslims.
They got them first at the mosques and then went to Pakistan.
They got, right. So these youngsters, so now let us specify, these youngsters were English born, right? Or they had lived a long time in England, and I think, didn't all three of them, all four of them, the English nationality? I forgot. Right? So they were really homegrown. So at home they learned a bit of the Quran. And they learned that they were Muslims and not Christians or secularists like everybody else around them in England. Then Some of them found the mosque where they found a very hot-headed preacher, and that preacher realized if this soul wants to be saved, England is not enough, this person better go and study in a Quran school in Pakistan. There's space here, come on. Yeah, we have lots of space here. And so that was the second step. Now, what else? How do you think? This person then comes back, goes to Pakistan, is still actually an alien, right? Feels, in a way, feels an alien in England, because in England that person is a Muslim, goes to Pakistan, is not really a Pakistani, because, you know, what the Pakistanis think and do doesn't really fit into the new mindset any longer. And then the person comes back in England. How do you think the person keeps up? I must tell you, in the meantime, the preacher is in jail. Because the preacher that was the inspiration behind these four was jailed 2 years ago. Was put in prison at last. I mean, at last. The guy should have been pushed, put away 10 years ago. But the British in their, you know, freedom of religion, blah, 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 freedom of speech, just let him say the most awful things. He was the one who organized the commemoration for 9/11, a feast, a festivity, 1 year after 9/11. Now think about it, you know, if you do that. So where then would the person go to get information?
The internet.
Right, the internet. Now everybody is a specialist of religion, because there is the internet, and you can get everything from the internet. If you want to say, what did Bin Laden say? If you want to know what did Bin Laden say again, you go to the internet and you look at his advice and his interpretation and this and this that. The internet. So you see, very, very modern. Very ultra-modern mode of getting information. Now, who is behind the internet? Really? If you go online and there is islamonline.com, and there's lots of sites, the majority of the sites, who is actually behind the large sites where you can go and get advice? Do you have any idea, or can you guess?
Saudis.
The Saudis. All the main interpreters of Islam, whose ideas are pushed into the world, pushed, okay? Through the internet, are either from Saudi Arabia or are trained there. Does this mean they have fun, diverse, intellectual, creative approaches?
No,
they are as boring as they come. They're all the same, right? Because that is the idea. So what we have to do here is we have to write someone the big SA. The big SA that somehow hovers over everything. So what do you have? You have Muslims in their own countries. You have Muslims who immigrated from their own countries to the West. And you have Saudi Arabia, that from where there is this huge push going on to unify Islam. To unify Islam, because what is the ideal of Bin Laden again? To create one big
Islamic
Ummah, right. One big Islamic community. That is the idea. And you see, what is actually very interesting is that it has never been more easy. It has never been more easy, because now there are all these modes of communication, and you no longer have to tolerate these pesky Indonesians who mix Islam with all kinds of traditional culture and customs and dances, and, you know, who chant the Quran dressed in very bright clothing. Oh, what an abhorred, what do you call it? How abhorring, how terrible, you know, because you need to remember what you actually need to wear. If you are a good Muslim, white or black for a woman, remember, we talked about that yesterday. Plus, in Indonesia, even worse, you have women reciters of the Quran. Even worse, you sometimes have that Quran reciting contest that the winner is a woman. That is even worse. And then she can't go on because she is not allowed to recite the Quran in the Middle East. So she cannot go on to the international level. She stays national. So think about it. If the idea to make one big nation has never been more easy as it is now because of our modern world. And at the same time, the idea of what it is to be a good Muslim has never been more problematic and contested. And every individual Muslim has to wonder, how can I be a good Muslim? So, so there you have Saudi Arabia with its handy booklets and its handy, you know, guidelines. And many young people, because if you think again back to a young Muslim and a young Christian who's very, very on the far right, what binds them? They want instant results. I don't know. I guess I want instant results too when I was young, right? You want instant results. Is that, you are young, right? Do you want instant results, if possible? No? Okay. No, you are quick. You want shortcuts. That is the thing. You want a shortcut. You know, okay, the shortcut is the shortcut to heaven if you commit suicide, remember, if you are a suicide bomber. And so then you eat raisins there, like we had for lunch in the tofu dish. But the thing is this, you want easy answers, you want easy access, you want to know what is Islam. Forget about this imam with his complicated, oh, in 1200 someone said this, in 1300 someone said this, in 1600 someone said that. Forget about that. Just give me one answer that I can live by. And those answers are given by Saudi Arabia. Do I make sense what is happening? Can we follow? The plot is building up, okay, in this world. Now, when we then say suicide bombers, we have to make a few categories, because we cannot speak about just one suicide bomber who fits all formats. Because there is first the issue of Palestine. And Palestine is always considered different, special, standing on its own. And that is where the first Islamic suicide bomber appeared in 1983. In 1983, we had the first Islamic suicide bomber in Palestine. And if you ask, for example, some of the leading, more conservative sheikhs of Islam, scholars of Islam, is suicide bombing allowed? They will discern, they will say it is allowed, but only in Palestine. Of course, then they're already on the wrong track, because Western journalists will pen down, it is allowed. And then that will come on the front page of the paper. But what they are saying, in Palestine it's okay. Why? And I'll come back to that. The why it is allowed. And then that is what this brings us to jihad. I'll come back to that. Now, we know that Al-Qaeda has lots of, let's say, rebirths. Right? Al-Qaeda, we got to know Al-Qaeda in 9/11. Bin Laden, who just comes on TV with a towel on his head and a long dress on and says all kinds of beautifully sounding words in Arabic. But do you know that the guy actually says very few religious things? If you say religiously, what does he say? Well, jihad and ummah jihad. That's about it. He doesn't really speak religious. He had only once spoken as in a religious authority, and that is when he said that we could wage jihad against the West. And that was very wrong when he said that. He went completely against the Muslim tradition, and I'll come back to that and explain why. Okay? So Palestine is a different topic, and give me a minute to come back to that. And then you have the Al-Qaeda type, and that is what we saw in England. We saw that in Spain, right? We saw that when the embassies that were bombed in Tanzania, where were they bombed again?
Nairobi
in Kenya, and there was a second one?
Tanzania,
right? Yeah. So that is Al-Qaeda. From Somalia, our soldiers who were suddenly attacked in Somalia, Al-Qaeda plans and goes from country to country and has on-site people who will plan certain attacks. And then Al-Qaeda, I wrote there Indonesia and Nigeria, and I've been wondering, are you from Indonesia?
No.
You look very Indonesian. You look like my former neighbor there. So I thought, wow, and one day I'll start to address you in Indonesia. Okay, but Indonesia, you have a different situation than in Nigeria, but you also have the Al-Qaeda situation, like the Bali bombing, the bombing of the Marriott in Jakarta, That is, again, Al-Qaeda inspired. We call that loosely Al-Qaeda because, you know, they don't have a telephone to Bin Laden. They've probably never seen or seen the guy or spoken to him, but it is the way, it is the method, and it is also the justification that you could call Al-Qaeda. And then you have, in many countries, and I have to really write Africa in big letters here, in many countries we see the struggle for the soul of Islam. That, again, Saudi Arabia, right? Many countries, think about countries of the former Soviet Union. Chechnya, all these towns like Dagestan, Tajikistan, right? Think about former Yugoslavia. Think about Albania. Think about Indonesia, where the dictator Suharto stepped down in 98 and suddenly the place opened up and you could basically, you know, air your own opinion, which was not possible before that. Think about the whole of Africa. There is somehow a battle going on about how can you be a Muslim, as I say, individualization, but also where is the local Islam? Where is the cultural Islam? And what do people do? And how can you ban it? How can you eradicate it? Because now we get the W word, the Wahhabi word. Do we remember the Wahhabi word? Who remembers Wahhabi? The Wahhabites from Saudi Arabia, right? That is, when we say Saudi Arabia, that is the philosophy, the Wahhabites, that is the philosophy that we actually refer to, and that started in the 18th century with someone called Abdul Wahhab, and he looked around him and he said, oh, Islam is on the verge of dying out. I have to do something. I have to purify it. Why did he say it was on the verge of dying out? Because a lot of Muslims were mystics. And folk culture had slipped into Islam. They would go to graves of saints and they would sit up all night and chant verses from the Quran. And he felt that is not pure Islam. That is not what the Prophet did. I must do something. So he started to, for example, basically demolish the graves of venerated sheikhs. And he started to apply the Islamic law by stoning. For example, there's a story that he came in one village and he said, is there someone here who was supposedly suspected of adultery? And they said, oh yeah, we got this woman. Okay, let's stone her first to set an example. So that was, he was really, what shall we call him? A modern day, I don't know.
Inquisitor.
What?
Inquisitor.
Yeah, that's a nice one. You know, he was a little bit like the Inquisition. And he wanted to set examples. And he did that really, really, really very crudely and very violently.
When was this?
He lived in the 18th century. He didn't write much, because there you come back to this whole package. The people who belong to this kind of mode of thinking and want direct, instant answers, they don't bother too much about philosophy. Philosophy is too, you know, makes you dizzy. They don't bother too much about theology. They don't bother too much about literature, arts. They don't bother about mysticism. Actually, the founder of the Wahhabites, he only wrote one small book. From the same time, there's another book written by his brother, and his brother complains of what a zealot his brother is. It's just, he can't believe it, you know, the zealotry that he exhibited there. And so what we have is this idea that you have to purify Islam, this Wahhabi idea. And as I say, nobody would have cared ever about this Mr. Wahhab, okay, had he not gained political power with the House of Saud. Because he gained power with the House of Saud, his ideology became the mainstream ideology of Saudi Arabia. And that's our headache till today. And then our next headache is that Saudi Arabia found a pot of gold. If they would have stayed Bedouins, we wouldn't have a problem either. They found this immense fortune and decided to turn a lot of it into mission for Islam, a certain form of Islam. Can we all follow me? Other questions by now, or shall I go on? Yeah? Okay, because I'm in a hurry. There's so much to stop to discuss. So we remember the W word, Mr. Waha. Hey, would you like to sit? You want a chair? No? Okay, there are some chairs left if you want. Okay, it's up to you. Yeah? Okay, no, you're very welcome if you want to sit down. Now, so this is the purification, see? Here, the purification. And we didn't put down simplicity. Simplicity. That is simplification. So in a way, what I'm just telling you about Mr. Wahab, who is the first enemy, really? Is it the West?
No.
No. Who was his first enemy? Other Muslims. And that is still today. The first enemy really is not us. We think we are, because when something explodes in London, we're so upset that, you know, we think, why us? But if you look at how many Muslims die in this struggle, it's far more than Westerners and Christians. Far more Muslims die in this struggle. You know? So the first enemy is, the first jihad is against other Muslims. And those other Muslims are progressive, moderate, God forbid, intellectual, you know? All these people that come with ideas that might make you doubt. Doubt is not good, remember? If you are in doubt when you are on a suicide mission, it will go wrong. No doubt. Right. Okay, so now we go first to jihad. What actually is jihad? Who was the first jihad to? I know someone who knows it. I forgot your name. You study in Yale. Who was the first jihad against? You know it.
I forget again.
Okay. Well, we have to jump back for a couple of hundred of years, yeah?
The Christians?
No, not at all. The Prophet Muhammad hardly knew Christians. The first jihad was against the polytheists of Mecca, because thinking historically for a minute, Prophet Muhammad was born and raised in Mecca, was doing fine there, until he got the inspirations from the Quran that said, no, there are not lots of gods and goddesses like you think here in Mecca, but good people of Mecca, there's only one God. They would have said, fine, were it not that they had a center of pilgrimage to all those gods and goddesses. And you, of course, if you think through, pilgrimage is extremely, extremely profitable. Very profitable. So they got really annoyed when he attacked their wallet, their source of income, and they wanted to murder him. And that's where he had to move from Mecca to Medina. And that is in the year 622, and that is considered the turning point of Islam. That's called the Hijra, and that is why Muslims start their dating with the year 622 Hijra, the flight from Mecca to Medina. Okay? Now, the people from Mecca, they were powerful lords in Arabia at the time, and they just didn't want to let this die out. So they started to attack the Prophet and his followers. And at that point, 622, his followers were considered pretty much a bunch of losers. You know, poor people, nothing to lose. They're just, okay, we can become Muslim, doesn't matter. We see the light, because they had nothing to lose. And so the Meccans felt, okay, we can easily trample them and just eradicate this sect or this new group. And so to resist the Meccans, to fight against the Meccans, to defend yourself against the Meccans, that was jihad. That was jihad. Because what does jihad do? What is the ultimate goal of jihad? The protection of the Muslim community. So anybody who attacks you, you fight. You fight people who attack you to protect the Muslim community. You see? And so that is how the jihad developed. And as Islam spread, and until around the year 1258, we had a large empire where Islam slowly spread, and Islam did not spread by violence. It spread by demographics. Intermarriage was the strongest tool of the Muslims. Intermarriage, because a Muslim man can marry a Christian woman or a Jewish woman, and then the children are automatically Muslim. So 2, 3, 4 generations down the line, the whole family is Muslim. And if you look at the Middle East, we know that the Middle East was Christian, right? Do we know that? Jordan, Syria was 100%, well, what do you call Christian? They were Christians, illiterate Christians, so to speak, but they were Christian. And it took about, until the Middle Ages, about the 14th, 15th century, when the balance tipped and the majority became Muslim. So that was about 800 years. 800 years before Islam gained the upper hand. Mm-hmm. But the rulers were always Muslim. So they ruled over large areas that were not Muslim. They were largely Christian or Jewish or Manichaean or Zoroastrian. Right? Do we all know that? Did we know that? So there was not that much need for jihad, really. So after the first years, after the first, let's say, the battles with the people from Mecca and fighting people who contested the Muslim supremacy, after that, jihad was seen as something that you do privately. Privately, you do your prayers and you believe that there's only one God, because if you don't believe that, then you're not a Muslim and Islam will die out. Right? Privately, you teach your children. That's jihad too. Because if your family is not Muslim, Islam will die out. So that was then considered jihad. From, let's say, the 9th until the 20th century, jihad was inside yourself. And so I'm sure many of you had Muslims speaking in their church, in your churches, saying jihad is my spiritual struggle and the struggle against my sins. Has any of you heard that?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That is, and that was true. That was. Now, who changed that paradigm? That paradigm was changed by someone. It was changed by a few people, but as you see, first of all, Mr. Wahab, right? He said, I have to start a jihad, but it was against other Muslims because Islam is in decay, right? I have to make sure it doesn't die out. That was the first step. But the second step, and that is what we are looking at and what gives us a headache, why were we drawn into the jihad? Because the strange thing was, the jihad was very seldom against Christians or Jews. Very seldom. This is a complicated matter I cannot go into. But most of the Christians and the Jews had a special position in the Muslim empire. And as long as they paid their taxes and did not do overtly missionary work and stayed to themselves, they were left alone. They were, however, not allowed to build new churches. And they were not allowed to expand. Now, what does that mean, actually? If you do not allow a community to have missionary work, what?
You die out.
You die out. It's a death sentence. It's like a death sentence. It's a very slow death sentence. But, you know, the rule, we have to give credit there, the rule comes partly from the Prophet Muhammad, but partly from the Roman Empire. Remember the Apostle Paul, who was a Roman citizen and hence had to go to Rome to be executed? Roman citizens had another status compared to other citizens. Remember, and so there's a difference in status. Okay, but that means Christians, there were uprisings of Christians in the empire, but they were put down. But on the whole, the jihad was not against Christians. It was to defend the empire, whoever would attack it. Now that changed. That changed in about 1950 something, and I always forget the year. I think it's 1958. And there was a man called Said Qutb. Has any of you ever heard of him? Said Qutb.
Yes.
You have heard of him. What did you hear of Said Qutb?
He's a very influential writer who was finally executed about 1964.
Yeah, 66. I had to look it up. He was executed in 1966. Wow, I very much admire you knowing all this. How do you know that?
I've read some books.
Yeah, but what was it what was it that his main ideology was?
I think he was very anti-imperialist, and he wanted to take Arabia back to the Arabs. And, you know,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
So jihad would be maybe the right word again.
Well, first of all, he was still ticked because of the colonialist era, right? The colonialist era, not area, era. Because the British, you know, it lorded it over Egypt and put in their Christian schools and, you know, just kind of suppressed Egyptians with their Christian ideas. He didn't like that. But you know what tipped the scale? I don't know if you happen to read that. What tipped the scale for Said Qutb was his years in the United States of America. He was here. He was a teacher, and then he became an employee of the Ministry of Education. And in that capacity, he was sent for further education to the States. And there he saw something. Oh my God, that was so terrible. He could not get over it. There were very few Muslims in those days in the States. It must have been the 40s, right? 40s, 50s, very few Muslims. So he was sometimes invited by Christians. And once he was invited by a pastor. Did you read that story? But a pastor in the church for a social evening. What was the social evening? Men and women, unmarried, dancing in the basement. And the pastor turned down the lights. Said Qutb knew there can be nothing good coming from this civilization. Total destruction. Dancing in the dark, unmarried. What do you... Just think about it, okay? So Said Qutb went back to Egypt in total shock. And in Egypt, he started to fight against the government that he felt was not really Muslim, okay? So again, other Muslims. The government was too secular. It was not Islamic enough. And that is why he ended up in jail, and that is why eventually they executed him, because he was, you know, trying to dissolve the Egyptian state. But in prison, he wrote a book. It's called Milestones, and you can get it very free, of course, subsidized by Saudi money, right? Get it very cheap, you can get it. And in that book, he made what I call a hermeneutical acrobatic jump. What did he do? He started to divide the world in two. One part of the world was Muslim, and the other part of the world was non-Muslim. Now, non-Muslim was everybody who was maybe born and raised Muslim but was not following the rules of Said Qutb, right? Who was, like, as I say, a liberal or a moderate or an intellectual. That was a non-Muslim. So, as I said, the first war was against Muslims. And they also started to figure out, you know, they had to figure out, how am I a Muslim then? And some of them would go and live in caves. And haha, those caves were from the early desert fathers and mothers, but they probably didn't realize that. And they would live in a house together and be very strict there, and you know, have strict prayers together, and not ride bikes, because they weren't sure that the Prophet ever would have ridden a bike, and things like that. So they were trying to figure out, how can I be a good Muslim, a pure Muslim, and how can I follow exactly the model of the Prophet Muhammad? So they were actually a sect, right? They acted like a sect, the followers of Said Qutb. And it was mainly inside Egypt that this philosophy was practiced. But then, part of the non-Muslim world was the West. And the West, as we know, was mostly Christian, or, well, wasn't that secular yet in the time that Said Qutb wrote. And so you see, all of a sudden, what you get is very interesting. According to the Quran, Christians and Jews are people of the book. They have the same book given to them as Muslims, however they changed it. But God gave them a book, and that is why they have a special position, and that is why they should not be murdered for their faith. That is what it says in the Quran. Said Qutb, however, made Christians and Jews into non-believers. Do you see? He made us polytheists. And that then later on, this was simmering for many years, and then by 1983, that was about the time that idea was translated into a first suicide mission, because then the idea was anybody who is not following the true rules of Islam or anybody who is attacking the Islamic world or an Islamic country or an Islamic community can be killed. Because according to the Quran, anybody who is a non-believer, which should be especially polytheists, but also Hindus, Buddhists, can be killed. And you, if you go to Egypt, you will not find a public Buddhist or a public Hindu. I have met people who are Buddhist in deep, deep, deep secret. Deep secret. The moment it would come out they are Buddhist, they will be killed. And of course, don't think India now, where there are 100 million Muslims among 900 something million Hindus. That's a headache, you know. There they hit the problem they had not foreseen. You know, if the majority is so massively Hindu, you can't kill them all, right? Then you have a problem. So there, the rule kind of could not be applied. But do we see what happened? Do we see what happened? So what I am saying is that Said Qutb and then his followers, the people who follow his line of thinking, like Bin Laden, they are actually acting against the Quran. They are committing a sin. It is not in their holy book. If you take your holy book seriously, right, you should follow what's in the holy book. They're not doing that. No. No. They have interpreted according to their own desire and need. And so that means, what does that mean? This is very interesting, that many Saudi sheikhs don't like Said Qutb at all. So he's a freewheeler. He's a freelancer. He is not a scholar of religion. Remember what he was? No, teacher, elementary school teacher. That's how he started out. He started out, no offense, you know, but he didn't study 20 years of Islamic knowledge. He didn't do that. He was a teacher. So they say, well, this, what do you call it? Upstart, freeloader, what do you call someone like that? Right? How can he say such things with such authority? So you see, it comes back again to the issue of authority. Who has the authority? Well, he gained it. People who wanted to do something, who wanted to have some action, gave him the authority instead of the sheikhs who had studied for several dozens of years. You see? Can you still follow me? Yeah? Okay. So you see what is happening. And so now, again, if we take Said Qutb and we take the beginning of this movement, then we think again individualization of the interpretation of Islam. And as as modernization goes on and as our world continues, so to speak, that problem is not gonna go away. Because what you have now is that part of the Muslim community, you know, wants to interpret the Quran very, very literally, very dogmatically, very narrowly, wants to have truth, 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 very much like some of us Christians do, right? And others say, no, it's much more complex, life is much more colorful, and so forth and so forth. Can we follow me? Yeah? And so that's a huge battle. That's a huge battle that we're witnessing. Now, any questions about this? Till what time do we have time? Till when do we have time? We have still 20 minutes, right?
Does jihad have a specific what was the meaning of that word?
Jahada is to exert yourself for Islam, to do an effort, to apply all your energy to something. Yeah.
You mentioned the Saudis subsidized milestones and.
No, they did not. The Saudis, they did not subsidize milestones because that was still the time the Saudis were not using their money yet. That started in the 70s, 80s.
So they are still united in their opposition to.
They don't like him. They don't. Some Saudi sheikhs don't like him. But again, it's the pick and choose. You see, you have a website from Saudi, and then you have a website that gives you the side good readings, and you take what you like. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the basic difference between the Wahhabi and the Said Qutb? What's
the difference? The basic difference is that
it's
first of all very cultural, because we constantly mention the word culture. It's very cultural, you know. Abdul Wahhab, he was a Saudi person. He was from Arabia. He was a Bedouin. who was from the area where Islam was born. He had no social program. He didn't care about, you know, poverty, empowerment of people, no. All he cared about was to keep Islam as clean as possible. Said Qutb comes from the tradition of what you call the Muslim Brothers. The Muslim Brothers had a deep social program. They wanted to make Islam a power in society that could give people hope. And they, for example, built hospitals. But then they felt that their program couldn't be applied quick enough because that, you know, that massive government was sitting on top of them and holding them back. So that's why they wanted to, you know, to eliminate the government and take over the power. Because as we keep saying, it's all about power and money eventually, isn't it? Power and money, that's what it comes back to. And so does that answer your question?
So he was also responding to colonialism.
Yes.
As well.
No, Abdul Wahab, no. Because the Saudi Peninsula was never really that severely colonized. Too hot, you see. Too much sand. Not interesting to go there. Egypt's much nicer. You have pyramids, the Nile, palm trees, strawberries. See? Much nicer place to colonize. Yeah, that's why the Dutch colonized Indonesia for almost 500 years. Nice place. Sorry, I don't know.
Jihad can have other meanings, can it not? I had a student from Syria whose name was Jihad.
Yeah.
And he told me that his parents named him that because it meant good works.
Yeah, it can exert yourself for God. So as I say, to follow the five pillars of Islam, to practice Islam, to be a good Muslim. Yeah. Now it's of course a bit of a bad name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. maybe you could choose a nickname now. G or something. Yeah.
Perhaps you talked about this in your other session, but what is the main inspiration behind a suicide bomber?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are many analyses, and they go from wanting to be the best of all Muslims, because there's really a degree of arrogance involved, that you are way better than others. And thinking that you, because that is the ultimate thought, that you, because you die to make Islam grow, to make Islam stronger, because you die for that, you will be a martyr and go to heaven. So it is the powerful idea that you can be a martyr, right? Which again was never really that visible in the history of Islam until about the 1980s again. Did you want to
add? Where did the 72 virgins come from?
Yeah. Well, in the Quran it says there are huris in paradise. And the 72, if I'm not mistaken, is in the tradition that the Prophet was once asked, how many huris will we have? Huris, whore, that's where the word comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it doesn't say 72 in the Quran as far as I remember.
But I mean, wasn't that one of the promises that they were promised, these suicide bombers in Palestine, that they would be rewarded?
Yeah. If they're men. Yeah. Yeah, but they basically promise paradise. You know, it, as I say, it's a shortcut to paradise, and you will be awarded for defending Islam. Now, of course, think it through. A lot is just in the mind, because what does it mean defend Islam in London? Huh? What does it mean? What would the result be if we all collapse? Okay, the United States collapses, England collapses. What good would that do to the world? What good would that do to the Muslim world? Nothing, right? Because we are all tied together. We economically, we are tied together. But there's so much exchange nowadays. Intellectually, we're tied together. So there's a lot just in the head. And I give you an example to show why there's a lot just in the head. Now, on top of that, there is indoctrination. Has any of you seen these movies made by Hamas in Palestine that now, you know, you start indoctrinating boys at the age of 4 or 5. And then when their father is a suicide bomber, they want to be one too. right? That part of it is indoctrination. So they pick certain individuals. You see? They don't pick randomly. The Shaykh in the mosque has a very deep psychological insight in who could do this. You see, and he made, for example, he made a mistake with that Richard who wanted to blow up a plane with his shoe, remember? He was fumbling. He wasn't goal-oriented enough. Maybe he was multitasking. I don't know what he was doing. You see? But so you see, it's a deep psychological insight. You need to pick the person who wants to do that for you. And don't you think that's the same? We find the same in parts of Christianity or in a sect, right? And then there's something else.
Money.
Part of it is money. In Palestine, you know your family will always be taken care of because that's a model Hamas has. They will send your kids to school. They will, the family can go get certain vouchers, can go to shops and get everything for free. Drugs. Mm. Some people are high when they do this. They take certain drugs and they give them certain drugs. Mm. And so you see it's a combination of many things. But the idea for you personally is an arrogance. You are better than anybody else. You go to heaven and you defend Islam. You defend Islam. And as I say, it's all in the head. Let me give you an example. Remember Sadat, President Sadat from Egypt. Remember that he was murdered in 81? You know your dates. Okay, 81, right? Okay. 1981, he was murdered by soldiers who belonged to the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, that this side Qutb was a member of. And these soldiers felt that Sadat, he was called the Pharaoh, which means total heathen, right? Pharaohs, heathens, polytheists, can get worse. And a day after he was murdered, there was a pamphlet on the streets in Cairo, which loosely translated was called The Forgotten Duty. The Forgotten Duty, which means jihad is a duty, as prayer is a duty, as fasting during Ramadan is a duty. This duty we have forgotten. You see? You see? Understand the title? The Forgotten Duty. Now, in that book, the orchestrator of the murder writes that he expects that the moment the Pharaoh falls, that Sadat falls, that he is killed, somehow an Islamic state will materialize in Egypt. How is unclear whether he thinks that heaven will open and angels will descend, or maybe the Prophet Muhammad will come down. How is unclear, but he somehow thinks that suddenly the whole of Egypt will be converted, has this, you know, born again experience, like, oh, we were all wrong and now we see the light. Well, you don't know Egyptians if you think that. Because what every Egyptian mostly wants is eat a pile of round loaves and have their double baked beans and sit with the family. You know, you don't really understand the psychology of your people. So you live in a dream. You live, and again, you keep seeing that. Like, do you remember the interviews we saw of Bin Laden on TV? Remember that movie that was made with the Sheikh who had no legs? Any of you remembers that after 9/11? Bin Laden was sitting in a room with this guy with no legs and boasting about 9/11 and saying that now the whole world was slowly coming to Islam. And of course, he made me crying with laughter when he said that in Holland, 100 people had spontaneously embraced Islam. Dutch people embrace nothing, let alone Islam. So, you know, I'm Dutch, I know. So, but there was this ideal, this vision that somehow God then, you know, if I am the instrument, God will take hold. You see what I mean? He will take charge. And I keep saying, it is in the mind, because imagine all of us tonight decide we become Muslims and we form Bin Laden. We say, whole the village has converted. What on earth is he going to do with us? You know? But we are then be Muslims who have read philosophy, theology, who are cynical, who have questions. We'd be a headache. Wouldn't we? So you see, it's very much, it's an ideal, and the ideal comes from the time of the Prophet Muhammad in Medina, when the Muslim community was a handful. And there's no way to develop that ideal and put it in the 21st century. But yet people try. You see? It's like people who start an ideal community. Can we think of any idealistic, ideal community?
Hold the village.
Huh? Hold the village. But they're not that, you know, we're not brainwashed.
Jones.
The Jones people. The Jones people. Perfect example. You see, you take a community and you just tell the people this is truth and we are. But again, there's an arrogance in there. There is an arrogance. Don't forget that, yeah?
I think going back to Palestine, another big issue with the suicide bombers there is the oppression that the Palestinians live under, and that is a huge influence in their actions and what they are led to do because of the hopelessness of their lives there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I said Palestine is a different case. Plus, the idea that Palestine used to be and well, it wasn't really independent, but had its own land, and that the land was taken away. So the idea is Muslim land was taken away, and that should not be. Hence Spain. Spain used to be Islamic, remember, or partly Islamic, and then the Muslims. In the Reconquista, in 1500, the Muslims were all thrown out. That is a deep, deep wound. A deep wound, that Muslim land was lost. That should not happen. It should only expand, you see? So that is why Palestine is different. Thanks for adding that. And of course, yeah, Palestinians suffer. They suffer terribly, and it is something that, of course, there's another issue. The Muslim world feels so, what do you call it? So powerless. You know, we've had the war of 76. We've had the war of 67, and they didn't win. And they had the majority that were, their forces were far in the majority compared to the Israeli army, and yet they lost. That, again, is also a huge wound in pride, right?
How much of a wound was the Yugoslavian ethnic cleansing as it relates to the international jihad today?
Not
period?
As much.
Not much.
No. In the Middle East, you know, white Muslims?
Right, they didn't.
It's kind of, you know.
So it didn't make any ripples.
Well, what is interesting is it comes up when it fits.
Right.
Like Bin Laden, have you also noticed, he always, his passion changes. He never mentioned Palestine, ever.
Right.
Remember? And then suddenly the Palestine matters. When he sees that the Muslim world is all up in arms about Palestine, Palestine matters. Yes, Yugoslavia, it becomes, for example, in the Wahhabi literature, it was a big theme. In the Wahhabi literature, it was a big theme, and it was portrayed as Christian against Muslims. White against Muslims. But the problem was they were all white, you see? But you would go to Egypt, and it didn't really enter the mind of people. It didn't really fit, you know, play a big role. So it depends a little bit of where you are, whether it was considered important. But it comes up when it fits. Does it make sense?
Thanks.
Yeah? Okay. Now, so can we follow my big scheme a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Now, so we've seen, we're looking at psychology. It is not just only sociology, because it's not only poverty. You know, a lot of the suicide bombers are not just poor and underdeveloped and undereducated. It's not just that. It is a sect-like ideology that can be triggered by modernity. It is also a reaction to modernity, right? To what the modern world is, because and now a Muslim living in the West has to defend him or herself against the outside world and has to defy what it is to be a Muslim. So you become a super Muslim, you know, you get a super identity, hyper identity. And then we have historical circumstances. We had the colonialism that bred an anti-colonial ideology, and then you have Al-Qaeda, you know, Bin Laden, who suddenly opened up all kinds of options that were not there before. He dared to do what people maybe had thought they wanted to do, but they didn't have the courage. He did it, and so and he also developed the methods, because, you know, now we know. You remember that in London, was it 2 weeks later, there was a copycat, mm-hmm. and people said, right, oh, this doesn't have the stamp of Al-Qaeda, it's different. You see, it wasn't as meticulous. So you see, there's all kinds of things happening. And then we have, of course, the political situations in many countries. As I said, former Russia, all these towns have now become independent. They used to be Muslim, but, you know, suppressed by communism. So they're wide open areas for Muslim missionary work, right? So there's lots happening in this world. And that is why I wanted to end with showing you. Oh, I have to end now. Can we take 5 more minutes?
Sure.
Yeah? I wanted to show you a little bit how this went in Indonesia. Because after Suharto fell, or stepped down or whatever, according to the rumors, his diseased wife appeared to him and said, "Man, let it go." And then he stepped down. So, anyway. You know, again, cultural Islam, believing in spirits of the dead, okay? Abdul Wahab would absolutely cringe in his grave. After that, what we saw is Suharto had suppressed extremist voices of Islam. And they had been hiding in Malaysia or in little Quran schools. After the democratic era, so to speak, opened up, started, all kinds of extremist groups popped out of nowhere. Overnight, one night there was nothing in the street, the next day you saw them with turbans and all kinds of things that I thought looked Middle Eastern, and long robes, walking the streets, giving out pamphlets, of course, all from Saudi Arabia, okay? Then what happened was the military felt left behind because Suharto was a general and was protecting the military and giving the military a lot of power. The military suddenly thought, oh my gosh, we're going to lose. We're going to lose our power and influence. We're going to do something. So what they did, they linked up with Muslims, with the extremists. They linked up with the extremists, using the extremists against the people, stirring up trouble, and then they could step in and say, see, we are needed big. See, we need to protect you, people, because these extremists can attack you. And then in the end, the extremists would lose out and didn't realize that they were used as tools for the military's interest. Same happens in Nigeria. So what do you have? Not exactly the same, but similar things. What do you have? You have engineered conflicts. Engineered conflicts. Do you remember in the year 2000 that in the Moluccans, about 2,000 people were killed? Christians. Now, how does this start? This book, The Spice Garden, written by Michael Vatikiotis, is a novel that describes something that sadly really happened. Really happened. A small island in the Spice Islands, the Moluccans is a group of islands, a very small island, where Muslims and Christians have lived together for centuries. One day, 7 young men step off the boat. They're dressed regularly in jeans and in a t-shirt, and they disappear into the house of the old Sultan, who is absolutely powerless, toothless, and so on. Okay? But since several years, the Sultan was sent money by the Wahhabis. Wahhabi missionaries to Indonesia from Saudi Arabia had visited the Sultan and said, "You are the protector of Islam. You should spread Islam." And the Sultan took that very serious and said yes and did nothing, okay? But they would put money in his bank account every month. These 7 come in his house and say, "Remember the money that is put in your bank account? We are here to activate you now." And so they link up with him and ask him to take them to the mosque. And then what happens in the mosque? Well, first of all, what they say to the Sultan, let me read for you. "Thanks be to God, Islam is the foundation of our national identity. Nothing should pollute this. For too long, our leaders tolerated the Christian scum and gave them leadership positions. But see what they did? They stole from the people and secretly tried to divert us from the paths of true faith. We can help you rid of these Christians." They said, "Yes, it's time to liberate these islands," chimed in a companion. "Freedom is purity of faith," shouted another from the rear. "But people will surely die," the Sultan said in a small voice. "Think not of those who are slain in Allah's way as dead." They then quoted the Quran. "Think not of those who are slain in Allah's way as dead. Nay, they live, finding their sustenance in the presence of their Lord. thanks be to God, to God they all mumbled. So you see, they used the Quran. Remember, I keep telling you, the Quran is so holy, so powerful. These people come and know a few verses and throw them in the Sultan's face, and the Sultan cannot but obey them. And then, because he doesn't know his stuff well enough to say something back, you see? So then what happens is, they go to the mosque, where the leader, called Umar, addresses the community. And again, first invocations in Arabic from the Quran. And the people are very impressed, because somewhere in the book it mentions that they find the ones who learn Arabic, the teacher finds the Quran so hard, the Arabic of the Quran, that he teaches Arabic from the stories of Thousand and One Night. One night. So that's easier Arabic, you know? Now, okay, so Umar stands in the mosque, and in front of him sit the island people who are very impressed by the way he knows Arabic. And they don't realize he only knows a few sentences. But, you know, they know nothing. So he says, it's time for the Indonesian people and the Muslim community, which are both now suffering, to come to a basic conclusion. So you see, the Muslim community is suffering. They are the victim. You see? They are the victim. Never mind that 92% of Indonesia is Muslim, the large majority. They are suffering and the victim. Time to come to a basic conclusion that if necessary, we must drive evil people out of this Indonesia we love, purify, send all the Christians out. Okay? There was a murmur of assent and ritual invocation from the back where his followers sat. And then it spreads. They find some young hotheads who want to join them. And what they do, and this is factual how it worked. One day, they just, while everybody is minding their own business, 11 o'clock in the morning, cooking the lunch, cleaning the fish, they go from house to house and slaughter everyone they can find in the house. Mm. And in the time of an hour, in the time span of an hour, they kill 56 people. Mm. And then they are stopped because, in the meantime, young Christians have formed a militia of their own and started to fight back. And then you get a standoff on the island, right? And then the military comes. Then the military comes in and saves the island. And in the end, both, this is why activists and non-governmental organizations are so important, because then it is found out who was behind this. And in the end, the military, the person behind it, was brought to court. And his sentence was that he had to leave Indonesia, and he's probably somewhere living in a nice suburb of Boston or San Diego here today. That was his punishment, and he probably has his monthly salary, you see? But this, you see, it is engineering. It is an engineering using Islam. And it can be very dangerous, because it can spread. It can spread, you know? If not, people in Indonesia would have stood up and said, we don't stand for this. And if not, Muslims would have said, no, we have been peaceful with Christians for hundreds of years. We are not allowing you to disturb this. I cannot tell you how big the bloodbath could have been then, you see? And so the struggle goes on, the struggle for the soul of Islam. That's what we're looking at. Thank you very much. Your dinner is waiting.